Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I thought we could start by kind of a state of the surge report. I was checking out California's wastewater sampling dashboard, and the state as a whole is at the threshold that it considers high levels of COVID now, although they're still quite a bit below the late summer, early fall surge we encountered almost 2 years ago. Also, nationally, one variant, NB.1.8.1, seems to be on course to dominate all of the samples that are collected from swabbing people. And my understanding is that typically when a new variant comes to exceed 50% of collected samples, that's a sign that it has enough of an advantage that it could potentially drive a surge. How are you looking at the data?
Well, many people have been predicting that we were going to see a summer surge. And I think that's coming to fore right now with the data that you just presented. And it's not just here in California, but it's in Nevada, Hawaii, Texas, Florida. So it's in a spotty fashion all over the country. I want to pause for a moment because we've been using now, Brian, for a long, long time, this word surge. And we are seeing a very significant uptick from our low point this late spring, very early summer. So we're seeing a very big uptick in cases. We're seeing an uptick in emergency room visits here in California. You mentioned the wastewater data. So there's no question that there's a significant rise in cases. But when we use the word surge, it brings at least my mind back to what we saw 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and it's nothing like that. So we're seeing an increased number of cases. People ought to be a little more cautious now than they were before, but it's very unlikely we're going to see anything like we've seen in those dark and even twilight days of COVID.
You mean cases flooding emergency rooms, pushing the medical response system to the breaking point?
That's right. That's right. It's hard to parse all of this out, and I struggle with how to communicate it because COVID's still a serious disease. It still is taking roughly about 200 Americans lives a week. That includes cases that are in the pediatric group. So it's still something that's formidable, that is a significant public health problem. It's a significant individual problem, but it's not what it was. And how to communicate that is difficult. I still think people need to be careful to avoid getting COVID, not only to prevent a disruption in their lives, but occasionally to prevent an ER visit, worse, a hospitalization, and tragically, sometimes a death. So those are good reasons right there. But I think people also, and you've emphasized this point, people also have forgotten about long COVID. And although we're seeing a fewer cases of long COVID now than we previously were, it's still a very significant problem.
It really still kind of a poorly quantified problem, right? Like there's dueling definitions of long COVID that you would use to track it. And then also people think of long COVID, they think of ongoing chronic symptoms or disability, but there's an equally concerning thing that shows up in the public health data is that people, after they're infected, after they've recovered from an infection and feel symptom-free, seem to have higher rates of heart disease, stroke, things like that, health complications that wouldn't be directly attributed to a history of COVID in someone's case file. You only see it at the population level.
That's right. That's an important point that's often neglected. We have to remember that long COVID is just a description that we've given a variety of different kinds of problems that people experience. So long COVID is a human construct. It's not something that nature necessarily does. Long COVID is something that happens when our body interacts with this virus in a significant percentage of people. And it manifests itself in myriad ways. And the cause of this is likely multiple causes that we don't understand yet. There's no one particular blood test you can do or an X-ray or CAT scan or MRI that will diagnose it. So it remains descriptive at this point. And this is how science in general, and certainly medical science, has progressed over the millennia. And that is, we describe something, we give it a name, and then we refine it and refine it and refine it. We've still got a ways to go with long COVID.
All right, we should open the phones at this point. It's 1-800-958-9008 to put your questions to Dr. Swartzberg. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. And I should disclose, I mentioned this in a place other listeners would have heard it, Dr. Swartzberg. I'm just now getting over my second case of COVID. I know the plural of anecdotes is not data, but as best as we've been able to reconstruct it, my wife and I caught the hot new variant by going on a hike with a friend who had no symptoms. It doesn't it speaks to the transmissibility of what's going around. We're two people who are otherwise quite cautious.
I know. I'm sorry, Brian. It doesn't sound like you're terribly ill, but I'm sorry that it got you. I think the point you're making is that you started the show by talking about the LP 0.8.1, 0.8.1, now the major subvariant. Why is it the major subvariant? Because it's more transmissible than previous variants. Doesn't make you sicker than the other ones. Of Omicron, but it does transmit much more easily. So what you experienced is what people are experiencing. And I think it's important to emphasize what you also mentioned, and that is you were with someone who's completely asymptomatic. And this is the really insidious thing about this virus. And that is that it spreads very well 24, 36, sometimes even 48 hours before people become symptomatic. And sometimes people never develop symptoms, but they can spread it. So it's a very, I use the word insidious, it's a very clever virus for propagating itself. Hope you get
Yeah, and
100% soon, and your
thank you.
wife.
Unless I sound like a walking advertisement for COVID being mild, I spent most of the weekend in bed. I am 3.5 days into a Paxlovid subscription, and I am flying high on Sudafed at the moment to clear up my congestion enough to sound coherent on the radio. So it wasn't any more fun the second time around than the first.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, what are you gonna do? Our first question comes from the inbox. This is from Amy in Oakland. Her question is about the changing federal guidance over vaccination, and she asks, will insurance companies pay for vaccines if people want them who are not over 65 or who have comorbidities?
I don't know. We don't know at this point. This whole issue about vaccines has been muddled terribly by the FDA, the CDC, and generally speaking by HHS, Human Health Services, by Kennedy. So we don't know exactly what's going to be approved to be paid for. Here's where we stand. We know there will be vaccine. We know the composition of that vaccine. It will should cover pretty well what you're experiencing right now, that particular subvariant. It's going to be the same as we saw, have seen all this year and last fall, the same thing we received last fall. So it will be, in that sense, a booster that will be available this fall. We know, as Amy was alluding to, that if you're over 60, 65 or over, if you have chronic conditions, certain chronic conditions under 65, you are eligible for the vaccine. And it will be paid for by the insurance companies, by the government. But if you're not in that category, it's really unclear. And it's a really cruel thing from a public health standpoint to not have this clarified, not have had it clarified for a few months now. We shouldn't leave the public hanging like this. And I'll give you an anecdote, and then comment on the insurance companies. The anecdote is that I was talking to a close friend of mine whose daughter lives is healthy, under 65, but lives with her husband, who has some serious underlying conditions that clearly put him at a high risk if he gets COVID. She wanted to protect herself from getting COVID, so she protects him, or at least helps protect him. She went to the pharmacy to get it. They wouldn't give it to her. It wasn't just insurance. They just said it's not approved for you, your case. So she's left hanging up in the air because the list that we got from the FDA, which was not evidence-based, which was not transparent how they arrived at it, but that list didn't include that particular category. And then finally, let me comment on the insurance companies. You and I mentioned this last week briefly, and that is that it's very likely that most of the insurance companies are going to cover the vaccine for those people that it's approved for. This wouldn't include Amy right now, but it would include people over 65 or people with chronic conditions. And the reason they're approving it, or will likely pay for it, is because the insurance companies know that it's a lot less expensive to vaccinate somebody than to treat them in the emergency room or in the hospital or in the ICU.
Yeah. Trust them to follow the bottom line. I think that the vagueness of the new guidelines is important to underline, and this is just kind of something about navigating the medical system as a patient, which is that sometimes you have to advocate for yourself and persistence pays off. Like there's a lot of room there for someone at your healthcare provider. Maybe it's a doctor, maybe it's a helpful nurse to kind of look at that long and vague list of qualifying conditions and look at your medical chart and kind of squint and think about how one thing is an analogy for another and say it works for you. But it's not necessarily going to be the first person you talk to. And we're not operating in a world where there's like cut and dried rules that are applied neutrally.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought it up. Th there is wiggle room here, but you're absolutely right. You have to be aggressive. If you really know what you want, work with your physician or healthcare provider and make sure that they understand your position and make sure they advocate for you in a way that will help. And make sure that if one pharmacist won't give you the vaccine, maybe another one will. So be persistent that way.
It's a shame. We have to be our own advocates in a medical system that we often deal with when we are incapacitated to some degree by illness, but that is the system we have. 1-800-958-9008 is the phone number for your questions to Dr. Swartzberg. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. Another question comes in from Wheeling, Illinois. Sarah Beth. She has a rather long letter here with a lot of statements in the form of questions, but I think the overall gist is she's curious about the role of antioxidants in your diet in fighting COVID.
I can be give you a pithy answer, and the pithy answer is there's no evidence that antioxidants in your diet will help you if you get long COVID or help prevent long COVID. Excuse me, COVID or long COVID. The longer answer is that there really isn't any strong science looking at this in any thorough way. So somebody claiming that if you take antioxidants, it's going to help you prevent getting COVID or help you prevent getting long COVID, or if you get COVID, taking it will help you get well more quickly or prevent long COVID. There's no data to support that. So that's all based upon somebody's belief system, not on any science at all.
Not a bad thing to have in your diet.
No, and the foods that contain antioxidants happen to be extremely healthy. So I think focus on healthy eating as opposed to specific ingredients within those foods is the way to look at keeping yourself healthy. And it seems like intuitively reasonable to say that if you're healthy, you're likely going to handle an infectious disease better than if you're not healthy.
Right. I mean, you can even kind of see that in the data that a lot of the things that increase the likelihood of severe COVID are diet-influenced medical conditions like obesity.
That's right. The promotion of these selected ingredients within food as a way of maintaining your health is based upon an industry that makes an awful lot of money over people's fears and concerns. And the best science we have now is that eating a very healthy diet, and we can talk about what that is, but eating a very healthy diet is what's necessary to maintain your health. And these supplements of different things that people believe in and people are making a lot of money on don't have any strong substance in science.
And every time we have a nutrition expert on, they say Michael Pollan pretty much nailed it when he said eat food, mostly plants, not too much. let's go to our phone lines, which are rapidly filling up. Joanne just hopped on the lines from Oakland. Good morning, Joanne.
So I know you've spoken about this before on air, but I am wondering about the timing of a vaccine after a known exposure.
After a known exposure or infection, Joanne?
A known exposure.
So you were around someone who was sick, but as far as you know, you didn't get infected yourself.
Correct. So is there any advantage to getting vaccinated the next day? Or waiting 5 days to, is there,
Oh,
you
you
know, is
mean
there a
like to
good?
prevent you from getting sick after an exposure?
Correct.
Got it. Dr. Swartzberg?
That's an interesting question, Joanne. There is an answer to that, and that is based upon the concept that COVID is a short incubation disease. By that I mean that Brian has COVID now. He knows when he got exposed. It wasn't too many days before he got sick. Typically, it's 2, 3, 4 days, sometimes 5 days, occasionally a little longer. So it's a short incubation. That is, it's short between the time you get exposed and you get sick. Because it's such a short incubation disease, getting the vaccine after you've been exposed is like closing the barn door after the horse is out. It won't help you for that exposure. There are some infectious diseases where if you know the date of your exposure and you get it the vaccine pretty quickly, it will help modify or prevent your disease. And the one that's been in the news so much this year is measles. It has a long incubation period, average 10, 12 days between the time you get exposed and the time you get sick. And if you get vaccinated within the first few days after exposure, if you're not previously not immune from vaccination or having had measles, if you get vaccinated a few days after exposure, it's going to help modify very significantly the course of measles you would get or prevent it. So there are some diseases, but unfortunately, COVID's not one of them.
Good
So,
question, though,
what
Joanne.
would you
Thank you.
recommend? What would you recommend then about when to get exposed after get vaccinated after 5 days, after 10 days?
Oh, you're saying when should you get vaccinated after you've been exposed in terms of protecting you in the future?
You answered the initial question. So then the second question is, so what would be the recommendation about when to get vaccinated given our current circumstance for people who are 65 and over, compromised, et cetera?
So I guess your question, Joanne, is when are you sure that you didn't catch COVID from that exposure? And
Correct.
when can you go back on your regular vaccination schedule? Dr. Swartzberg, when is she in the clear?
Sure. That's a very important question, Joanne. And typically, I was mentioning the incubation period is 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. It can go out a little bit longer than that, 7 or 8, 9 days. So if you haven't come down with COVID after 10 days, 14 days, you didn't get it. Or if you got it, you didn't get sick from it. So anytime after that, getting vaccinated would be fine.
Sounds like it wouldn't hurt for her to do a home test at some point, even if she doesn't have symptoms.
Yes, and if it's positive, that would tell her she got infected but didn't get sick. But if it's negative, it doesn't tell you you didn't get infected and didn't get sick because there's
Right.
so many falsely negative tests.
All right. Good luck, Joanne. Sorry about that exposure. Next up is Ellie in Berkeley. Good morning, Ellie.
Hi. Hello. I'm curious about the possibility of COVID in a 2.5-year-old. And it's very rarely do I hear talk about what it's like for that demographic. And I'm supposed to be taking care of a 2.5-year-old who has a bad cold. And do they get a regular test? What is the disease like in that demographic, and how contagious, the whole thing for a 2.5-year-old to be around them if they have a bad cold and I don't know what it is.
Ellie, I'm glad you asked that question because people have this concept that little children, children under the age of 5, they really don't get COVID, or if they do, they don't get very sick from it. The hospitalization rates, the mortality rates to children under the age of 5 are sort of comparable to what we see in people 50 to 65. That is, it happens. And when it does happen, it can be very serious. So somebody under 5, particularly somebody under 5 who has never been vaccinated, is significant risk. And this is something that the FDA did not address or addressed in the negative, and that is it didn't talk about protecting otherwise healthy young children, and I think that's a mistake. So that 2.5-year-old, hopefully was immunized to protect him or her. Now, in terms of how sick the child has a cold right now, we don't know what's causing that cold. There are several viruses circulating that cause a cold. COVID causes a cold. We're not seeing much RSV now at all, and we're seeing very little influenza, so those two are unlikely to be causing it. So that child either has COVID or one of the other viruses that cause a cold syndrome. If the child is contagious with something, we don't know what it is, the child can be tested to find out. But I would approach that 2.5-year-old as if knowing that the child has an infectious disease, knowing that that infectious disease is a contagious disease, it can be spread from one person to another, and taking the precautions that you would if the child has any infectious contagious disease, including COVID.
Meaning mask, wash your hands, do what you can to not catch it yourself.
That's right.
And the home COVID test kits are approved for children above 2 years of age. Although again, they can produce false negatives. Dr. Swartzberg, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. And get better.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I'd appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.